Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. You remember that last week, I sort of tried something new and had an episode with just one guest, Yisid Etemadi. And I don't know, I'm kind of liking this new format, so I'm giving it another go today. I kind of like being able to do the longer, more in-depth interviews, especially, and I think part of that is I'm doing more interviews in person now, so it's giving me a chance to, actually have a decent conversation with people. But to the show at hand today, don't know how many of you have been listening for a while, but if you have been back in February of last year, you may remember my conversation with a Toronto filmmaker named Reza Sholeh. He's part of the team at N5 Productions, and at the time I spoke with him, they were in the process of finishing up season one of their web action series, Petrol. Reza's kept busy since then. He kindly came by my home studio to sort of update me on what he's been up to since our last chat. And Petrol finished production on season two, although it doesn't have a release date yet. But Reza is more than a producer. He's a writer, he's a director, but his first love was always acting. And he recently got to act in a film that was sort of one of the first projects he was a part of that him or his production team didn't really have much to do with. The film is called Detainee X, and it's about a young Muslim man who is unfortunately the case a lot of the time, wrongfully accused and tortured. And that part of the conversation takes some interesting twists and turns as Reza details why he underwent waterboarding, as part of the role. If you're triggered by something like that, just be advised that is in there. But it's interesting. Him and I are both kind of similar. We both started off as actors, and now we're sort of starting to get into the world of journalism a bit more, although I don't really believe this show is journalism per se. But Reza actually really got into that world as he was the director of a really, really powerful documentary, Passport Control. And in it, he finds himself in Thailand, actually. And he'll get into this in the interview, but he talks about how he tried to get his brother to safety in Canada to get him here. And so part of the reason he was in Thailand was he was trying to get in touch with a human smuggler, who could make that happen. And so it's a pretty stark conversation. It can be unnerving at times, but it's a very it opens your eyes and my eyes too, in a lot of ways. The one thing that we didn't get to talk about, that is of note is Reza recently completed his first voiceover work in a film called The Breadwinner, and it was recently nominated for Best Animated Film at the Golden Globes, and people are talking that it might get nominated for an Oscar. So we'll see if that happens. But this conversation is everything we talk about. Film, Canadian cinema specifically, immigration, politics, all that jazz. But enough of me. Here is me and Reza Sholeh. Reza Sholeh, hello, welcome. How's it going, man?
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me, then.
Surviving the this weather we got here
Oh
in the
man, it's
air.
insane. Yeah, today is what, January 5th? Yeah. And it's insanely cold with wind chill is, what, 30, minus 37. So I'm trying my best. And thanks for the tea, by the way.
No worries. I imagine that must have been a big shock for you coming from Iran when you first moved to Canada.
Initially, yes. And funny enough, like, I still remember the day that I got here. I came here in December 2006 and I landed in Montreal, so it was even colder than it was here, and I had no winter clothes, or at least I thought I did, but they weren't like winter clothes that would be appropriate for the cold here. So yeah, it was at first initially it was pretty damn shocking, but over time, like, you get used to it.
What is winter like in Iran?
Iran is an interesting country because we do have all four seasons, and it geographically is situated in a world in a way that in northern Iran we get full winter, minus 20, just like here, snow and the whole shebang, and it gets pretty cold where in northern Iran. And then in the capital in Tehran, you get all four seasons. It's sort of like more of a, it's got a European feel to it, where you get 3 months of winter, 3 months of spring, and then 3 months of summer, that kind of thing. I'm from the south. I'm from Shiraz, named after Shiraz wine. Well, the Shiraz wine was named after my city. And it's pretty hot. We don't get like crazy winter. Right now it's like 10 degrees plus 10. So it was pretty damn shocking. And I lived there all my life. Well, until I was like 18. So
the last time we talked last year, you were just finishing up season one of a web series called Petrol. And you have a lot of other really fascinating projects coming up. I initially reached out to you because you're in a film called Detainee X.
That's correct, yeah.
And, well, first of all, what was it like for you? Because I know, like, with Petrol, for example, you were involved heavily in writing, directing, creating, producing, whereas with Detainee X, you're just an actor.
Yeah.
What is that like for you, being involved in the project where you just have to do one thing?
I love it. It's the best because it takes all the pressure and the responsibility out of the process. I started as an actor. I always wanted to be an actor since I was a little kid. And when I came here, I went to school for acting. So the whole reason that I started doing production is because I couldn't get enough roles out there. And just like every other struggling and aspiring actor, it's hard. You go to a million auditions and you get one small role and they kill you off in like the first 5 minutes of the film. So I started learning about production, and with the hope that I'd be able to produce and create projects that I can put myself in and put myself on the map. And then it sort of started working out. Then I realized that I was better at that job, producing job, than I originally thought. But that, like, the passion for acting never went away, and it's always there, and every chance I get, I mean, any opportunity that I find, whether it's a stage or film, I embrace it and I love it. So it was easier because I definitely wasn't involved in the production aspect of it with Detainee X or the writing aspect of it. However, that's a very normal process where you do tweak and change scripts and lines a little bit as you're filming to adapt it more so to your personality. And then there were those conversations with the director, but that stuff I love passionately.
Just gonna close the door. I think it
no problem.
Blew open.
Yeah. That's how cold it is.
It's also how old this house is. You have to lock the door, otherwise it won't stay closed.
Oh, wait.
When I was reading up on Detainee X, Buna Mohammed, the director, stated on the crowdfunding page that the company, his company, strives to make Muslim films, Muslim-centric films. Why is that important, especially in the context of the culture and the sort of the cultural zeitgeist that we're in mm-hmm. right now?
Well, it's a very good question. To clarify, I worked how I got cast as that role. It was through the director of the film, which I had previously done a feature film with, which was not a Muslim movie. It was just a regular crime drama. And then he cast me, he got in contact with me again. He said he wanted to work with me, and that's the project that he had. And I accepted. I didn't choose the project because of the subject matter per se. But it was a cool story. It was an interesting story. And it was right around the time where there were a lot of buzz and news around the, Omar Khadr
settlement
and all of that. So it was a pretty hot topic everywhere. So naturally, I was interested. I wanted to know more about it. I think it is important to tell every story that is not getting enough press or the right press out there. I don't know Bona very well. I just met him a couple of times on set, but I think that's probably his motivation for telling these stories as well. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of, I guess, both emotional and physical violence
yeah.
directed towards your character
yeah.
in the film. How do you prepare yourself for a scene like that, knowing that you're sort of going to have to, you know, show these moments that we hear about so often in
the news? Yeah, that's a great question, because what happened, like, and one, I can give you one example that, like, on set, there is a scene of my character being waterboarded, and that we were trying to fake that and make that sort of work. And that was one of the first torture scenes that we witnessed we were filming, actually. And it just wasn't working because I wasn't being waterboarded. I couldn't feel the pressure. And it was literally nothing to grasp on in terms of drawing realistic performances or portraying them. So what happened was I asked the director if we can actually give it a shot. And I mean, we're in a safe environment, and if anything, I'll give him a signal that I would like tap my hand or whatever, so that if things are getting a little out of control. And he didn't accept. And then I was talking to one of the actor who was supposed to do it, and we did it. And we kind of, without him knowing, it was the waterboarding scene that you see in the film is actually me being waterboarded. And oh God, it was horrific. It was initially, like, when I heard about, especially this particular method of torture, I was like, how big of a deal is it? You just put a towel over someone's head, pour a little bit of water, you can still breathe. Not so much. The best, the closest thing to that, the best way I can describe it is as if, imagine if you were under, you could breathe just a little bit underwater, like just enough so that you don't die, but you go through all the pain of water going through your lungs and whatnot. So it was horrific. And then from then on, I realized that, you know what, in order to be able to portray the right performance, not to go to a full extent, but I need at least a little bit of what that torture feels like to be able to amplify it through my performance. So every torture that you see, we did just a tiny bit of it, like a very watered down version of it. I had them do it to me so that I can have a frame of reference.
How do you feel about going through that experience in terms of not only as a person, but in terms of it in enhancing the story that all of you are trying to tell?
Yeah, it's definitely tough, especially there are moments that I remember our production manager was watching, and She actually started tearing up a little bit, and any normal human being would and should. It's definitely difficult to think and imagine for a second that somebody actually is going through this. Somebody that could be based on this story, and obviously there are people who fully deserve it and should, like, worse things should be done to them. But this story is about a young Muslim American who literally has done nothing. He's very North Americanized. He reads comic books, he plays video games, he parties and smokes weed, and simply because of being associated with the wrong person and having the wrong name, gets caught and being put in jail. So it's emotionally it's very difficult when you think about it that way, because I'd never approach it as if this guy was a criminal, because he wasn't in the story. And I wanted to always keep that alive, because that's when you feel for the character.
The title obviously is Detainee X, and do you think like that's a comment on the system and how it so often doesn't treat people, whether they're guilty or innocent, as people, but rather just sort of as numbers?
Yes,
especially ethnic minorities.
Exactly. Yeah. That's very. That's exactly it. Actually, you hit it right in the head. Like that's exactly the reason, or at least that's what I was told that they chose that title. And if you actually pay attention when the film is going to be released, people will see that it's the name of my character's name is never revealed in the film. You never, until the end of the film, you never know what his name was. And nobody, funny enough, watching the film, nobody will ever question it. Which was always fascinating for me.
You mentioned that you guys were making this film when the whole settlement conversation around Cotter settlement was happening.
Yeah.
Where do you think the Canadian government is right now in dealing with these types of issues, whether it's, you know, wrongly convicted, you know, former child soldiers like Cotter, or, you know, crime amongst immigrants, or the whole justice system surrounding minorities?
To be honest with you, I don't know. I know very little about politics in general, and I know even less about Canadian politics, and this is such a delicate and complicated subject matter. As to me, I think if somebody's guilty, they should pay the price. If somebody's committed a crime, they should be punished for sure. And however, what makes it very difficult and challenging and complicated is the fact that a lot of the times people are paying the price for the crime they never committed, and that's the challenge. So I'm sure anybody in their right mind, it doesn't matter what position of power they are at or what office they hold, would think the same thing. Other than that, all I can do, literally, and again, that's one of those things that I don't know whether they are doing their best or not. But all I can do is hope that people in power and politicians would do their best to be able to serve. Serve people and with justice.
Now, in addition to Detainee X, you're also working on a documentary.
Yeah.
That I take it is a much more personal story for you.
Yep.
Passport Control, and this was about trying to get your brother into the country. We talked a little bit about before we started here, but how did this initially start for you? I get the feeling that it was going to be much more of a traditional documentary when you first started.
That is correct. Yes. So I came to Canada when I was 18 years old. In Iran, if you turn 18, if you're a boy, you have to serve the army as a mandatory military service. And if you don't, you can't get a passport, you can't get a driver's license, you can't really go to school. cool. You, there are ways to do it, but it's, life becomes very challenging and difficult for you. You can't even hold a government job. And it's a mandatory service, and it's very difficult. And should you be willing to join, there are chances that you'd be forced to serve the interest of the Islamic regime of Iran currently abroad in, let's say, Syria or Lebanon, or given the current political climate in Iran and the social unrest where people are out there in the street protesting because of the current economic situations and the foreign relation with the West, soldiers are forced to go out there and beat people up. And it's a very challenging and difficult position to be in. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to serve the country. There are ways for you to be able to buy it out, or if you know enough people in the government and high up, they can help you out and stuff. But I was living a normal life, not a great, like, fancy life or anything like that, but I didn't have any of those things. I didn't want to be forced to serve the regime that I didn't agree with. So I left the country, I escaped, and when I became a runaway soldier, you're wanted by the government, I went to Thailand through the aid of a human smuggler in Thailand. I was able to come to Canada as a refugee, and that was a long time ago, but it took a while for me to convince the refugee board here for them to give me permanent residency, because that's not a good enough reason for you to be a refugee in Canada or a protected person. But long story short, I got my status. And then fast forward to 10 years later, my brother in Iran, he was in this, basically in the same boat as I was. And again, like, given this current situations, and two years ago it was bad, now it's even worse, but there was no future for him. So I decided to bring him to Canada the same way I came, and however, and wanted to make a documentary about it, going through the process that I did, the dangers that I faced and whatnot. I wanted to document that. And when he gets here, the documentary was supposed to be a very, as you said, very conventional documentary, a lot of interviews and stuff like that. And when he gets here, documenting the process of the process of the migration, the bureaucracy, did all the paperwork, the
bureaucracy,
and the court hearing, stuff like that. But when he was on his way here in Hong Kong, he lost his passport, and the human smuggler who was trying to help him out got caught. So the format of the documentary sort of got changed. I actually stopped filming the documentary and I tried to help my brother. I had to go to Thailand to find another human smuggler who can help him out of Hong Kong. Now, he didn't come here, and that's sort of a cliffhanger of the film. So he's not here, but he was able to get out of Hong Kong alive.
You mentioned human smuggling, and I think people might get the wrong idea, because there is a difference between human trafficking and human smuggling.
Yes.
Human smuggling, those getting smuggled are actually in on it,
yeah,
as opposed to human trafficking. So maybe just elaborate a little on the actual process of human smuggling.
Yeah, for sure. So even people can even look this up on the Immigration and Refugee Board website, where it explains the difference between human trafficking and human smuggling. Human trafficking is when people are smuggled from one place to another against their will. It happens a lot with sex trafficking, also in Thailand, in Eastern Europe, and many other countries around the world. And unfortunately with women, that's very common in those countries and third world countries. However, human smuggling is when somebody is being smuggled from one place to another with fake documentations, as they request it. It's they're in on it, as you said. And it's simply because they either can't, for many different reasons, various reasons, they can't travel with their own passport, or they don't have a passport, in which was my case, and they want to seek safety and refuge in a safe place. So there are agents or human smugglers out there who know how to forge a passport, and they know the ins and outs of traveling with fake documents and illegal documents, and they'll basically teach you, train you on how to do it, and help you travel with somebody else's name and somebody else's passport.
Did you ever think, you know, you mentioned that you started this whole in this industry because you wanted to be an actor, mm-hmm. and with passport control, you sort of become an investigative journalist.
Yeah.
Did you ever think you'd go down that road?
No, I didn't. No, because when I wanted, the intention of making the film was to for it to be, as I said, like a very conventional documentary film. So I never planned on being in it. And the first scene of the film is actually, one of the first scenes of the film is an interview with an immigration lawyer, which was shot before my brother was caught. So I thought that was going to be the trend. And I'm not in it. It's just a very normal three-point lighting type of interview. When that happened to my brother, sort of the movie changed, and it wasn't about what it was before. It became about family, really. And it wasn't about the struggles of why people come here or leave, or the refugee crisis or any of that, which originally what it was supposed to be, but it wasn't about that anymore. It became about just the journey of me trying to help my brother out and what this little guy has gone through to get here. Or not here, but yeah.
Whenever I, you know, talk to documentary filmmakers, there's always a discussion about the filmmaker being in, like, in front of the camera, mm-hmm. and part of the story. And you obviously you mentioned initially that you weren't supposed to be in it.
Yeah. But
what went into that decision about eventually deciding, okay, I need to be on camera to make this story happen and to make it happen properly?
So what happened was, when I went to Thailand, I went with a friend of mine, and he, because I didn't want to go there alone, and he just continued rolling and was getting a lot of shots of me throughout this process. I was filming a little bit as well, but he was doing most of the filming. So when I ended up in the edit, I still had no idea when the whole shebang was done and over with, I came back to Canada, I still had no idea how it was going to be edited. My thought process was that in the editing room, that still this is the conventional documentary that I was going to have. And I realized that, I don't have enough interviews, or there's not enough material for that story that I originally wanted to say. So, and then I realized that there is a different story in here. There is something more raw. There is something more authentic than what I was trying to, the story that I was trying to tell. And then I saw a lot of me on the screen. So it was kind of it was a happy accident where I realized that, it is an investigative journalism type of film. And I ended up in the film. However, I did realize one thing that after going, because I did a few test screenings and stuff like that, and I realized that people do respond to a narrator and a journalist or a reporter or a filmmaker being on screen telling them where the story is going, what they're trying to do. It's a more interesting way to follow the story. So I like it.
There's been, you know, over the last few years, a lot of discussions on not only the state of journalism, mm-hmm. but particularly the investigative side of things. Yep. Like, CNN got a lot of criticized for sort of dismantling their investigative units, and CBC's gotten in trouble in the past. Why do you think a lot of news organizations are maybe erring on the side of caution when talking about these stories, and we're perhaps not seeing as much investigative stuff as we were in the past?
My opinion is because a lot of times when you try to dig into stuff in an investigative journalism way, you'll open doors to a closet that a lot of people don't want you to open. You'll find things that sometimes you wish as a journalist you didn't find, and it could backfire. And the reason that I think these networks and news channels don't or media doesn't really want to go down that road is because they'd rather be safe than sorry. And again, it's all about it's a capitalist world. It's a corporate world. So you could find a story that is fascinating, and it could put potentially a politician in jail for committing a massive crime as an investigative journalist if you go down that road. But also, that politician could potentially have a lot of friends, or there would be other people with the same baggage who haven't been caught yet that don't want to be caught. So they would put pressure on the network to not do that. So essentially, I think it all becomes about politics and capitalism. Really, it's all about the money and safety of the people in power.
I remember, you know, when I was in school growing up, when someone mentioned Thailand, one of the first things people thought of was the red light district. Mm-hmm. You know, Thailand has such a notorious red light district. Yep. What do we get, or do we get wrong? What do we get anything wrong about that country and about red light districts in particular, do you think?
Yes and no. So, the thing is, yes, Thailand does have a red light district, and prostitution is legal, technically, there. However, it is very much, what I witnessed was that it's very much controlled. And it seemed like that is controlled by the government. So you don't see women in the streets looking for business or prostitutes and in each and every corner. As you said, they're all the red light district, they're all there, and that's the hub of it. So the misconception that Thailand is probably is a dirty place and it's all about sex and whatnot is absolutely a misconception. It's not like that. It's a fascinating country, and that there are only a few cities that actually have the red light district, funny enough. You can't find it just about anywhere and everywhere. Like Pattaya, for example, 30 minutes south of Bangkok, is a small city which has the biggest red light district and the biggest prostitution business that I think Thailand has. And however, it is very much controlled. It's not a Wild West.
What was the strangest or maybe, you know, oddest experience you had while filming in Thailand amongst the red light district?
Oh, amongst the red light district?
Or you know, if there was something that just like, what is happening?
Yeah, well, there were two things. One strangest experience was the fact, because a few of the footage that I obtained was through a spy cam, because I was meeting with human smugglers, criminals, drug dealers, something like that, trying to find a human smuggler that can help my brother. As we sort of briefly discussed, this is not something that you can fill out an application for online or call somebody, be like, hey, I need someone to help my brother out of Hong Kong who doesn't have a passport. So I was meeting with a lot of shady people and using a spy cam to do it. However, there was one guy who had a prominent role in helping me find the right guy. His name was Phoenix. His name, I don't know, was still, I don't know if he's still alive or not, but a passport forger out of Thailand, in Pattaya, who also is a drug dealer, who didn't mind after he found out who I was. See, they found out about the spy cam and whatnot, strip searched me and all of that, but then he realized who I, like, that I, my, I wasn't a cop, and that's all he cared about, whether or not I was an undercover cop, he didn't mind me filming him. So after he found out that I'm not a police officer and I genuinely have a brother in Hong Kong, want to help him out, and he didn't mind me filming him at all. So I was able, he allowed me to follow him around, have a discussion with him, sit down and talk about how he does his business. And yeah, he, that was one of the strangest things that happened to me in filming this documentary. And but in terms of Red Light District, the weirdest thing was the fact that they have menus of women with pictures of women that you can choose from. So it's kind of like going to a restaurant and seeing a menu with pictures of food, because there's a lot of that. Their food, they put pictures of the food there because a lot of the them, because of miscommunication, a lot of them are not able to speak well English. So they put the picture of the food so people can see what they're ordering. It kind of went the same for guys in the street approaching you from different clubs and bars, and they approach everyone. They don't care. Women, men, old, young, kid, they come to you with like a little menu laminated with pictures of women, and you can choose whichever one you want and go do your business. So I found that extremely bizarre.
How much do you think your acting training and acting background came in handy when, in terms of preparing to talk to people who are or potentially dangerous criminals?
Nothing.
No?
It's all went out the window, believe it or not. Like, I was so nervous and just extremely high on adrenaline because, again, like, it was about the safety of my brother and nothing else. So that it just... I couldn't even, my hands were drenched in sweat every time I would talk to one of these guys. So it didn't help me at all, unfortunately. And there were a couple of times where I found myself just talking and talking and talking, and the guy was just staring at me like a dead stare. And I was like, oh, I wish I had shut up like 10 minutes ago. And there were a lot of moments like that, but yeah.
You mentioned that your brother's not actually in Toronto. So mm-hmm. is the story of passport control finished, or yeah. Are you going to do a follow-up in any way, maybe when your brother gets here?
My brother's not going to come here. He was able to get to safety in a different country. I don't want to ruin the surprise for the audience, but he was able to get to safety, and he lives and got asylum and refugee protection in a different place in the world, and has been good and has been living happily ever since. What I am interested in doing, because I found great relationships. That it's weird to say with some of the ex-criminals in Thailand, because that's how I got basically in and was able to find a way to find the current criminals through the people who used to do it and not anymore. And one of them was Mark Black. He was an ex-passport forger and currently works as a marketer, funny enough. But his father was also a counterfeiter, money counterfeiter in Thailand. So I found these great relationships, and what I find interesting is that what I'm looking to do is to do a docudrama, a docuseries about the criminal world and about Outlawland. I'm going to call it Outlawland. Every region has its own criminals that do their own little crime in their own little way, and I want each season I'm going to focus on different crimes in different regions of the world, and Thailand will most likely be passport forgery because I have sort of a experience there.
You know, whenever we hear the word refugee used in the news, it often precedes the word crisis.
Yeah.
Is that a fair assessment, do you think, of what is happening in the world right now?
Yes and no. Again, it's such a fine line to draw and talk about, because refugees have existed since thousands and thousands of years ago. Refugees always been out there in the world and running away for their safety. The whole crisis obviously started with the Arab Spring and the whole Syrian crisis and war, and it just turned into this massive phenomenon that have been a challenge for the Western world until today. So not every I don't think you and it is sort of inevitable, but I don't think you should associate the word refugee to crisis, because there are individuals who are running away for their safety that are not part of that phenomenon. Not that they should be given more advantage or less. It's just that I don't think there is a crisis. There should be crisis of refugees. There are crises in the world.
Lately, it seems like you've been making films with a strong social message.
Yeah.
Why is that important to you, and why is a film a good medium for that? How can films help us approach these issues that maybe other sort of mediums can't?
Well, 110%, that's films and television and the video media in general is the best medium to get any social message out there, because of the mass audience that is out there and have access to that and is willing to give you 5-10 seconds of their time, and if they're interested, they'll listen. Listen to what you have to say. So you essentially, with every film that you make, that's what the teaser is for. That's your pitch to the audience, that this is a story I'm about to tell. I'm gonna talk about this, and if you tell it well enough, they'll listen. So I think it's the best medium.
And you have one more project in the works. You have a couple, but the main one, Petrol Season 2. Obviously, the first season did really well, and you got some funding. Making a sequel to something or a second of something is not necessarily an easy go around. Yeah. How was the process different for you in the making of Petrol this time?
Yeah, it was easier in a way, because we were able to, because of the scheduling, and we were able to schedule it and shoot it chronologically in a way, and not sporadically, just like we did season one, because it was season one, we were still filming different episodes as some were even being edited, and it took a very long time. So this helped, because we were able to schedule it as a one big chunk and shoot it in like 30 days or so, and made it a hell of a lot easier.
You mentioned before we started that you're sort of not going to do the YouTube airing this time, as you did last time. So how is season two going to be plan to put out there on the web?
We don't know at this point yet, because we wanted to put it out there for free to see, first of all, if there is an audience for it, and second of all, gather our numbers and our audience, and then be able to leverage that and get it on a different digital platform. At this point, we don't have anything lined up or anybody even interested yet, because that hasn't been is being edited as we speak. And but yeah, the goal is to be able to get it on a different OTT platform.
It is at its heart an action series.
Yeah.
And they've been around forever, and I think a lot of action films get criticized for a lack of plot. They're much more about the spectacle of, you know,
yeah,
things like Fast and the Furious and a lot of the shoot 'em up ones. But why do you think, at least for the first season, that the audience did resonate a lot with Petrol?
I think it was simply because we didn't have the budget to do crazy action sequences, nor did we want to. I think lack of funding sort of worked to our advantage, because it made us work harder to make the story more interesting, and so that when we are shooting an action scene, it pops and it's given the attention that it deserves. A lot of times with, as you said, look, a lot of the Fast and Furious movie and other action films, what happens is that because of the funding that they have access to and massive budgets that they have, they could get lazy with the story, and or on the other hand, they could lose track of the story because they want to jam pack it with action. So at the end of the movie, you don't even know what the hell you watched, or it was just a bunch of people shooting at each other and running away in a car. Whereas with this story, with our project, it was about. It was always, the story always came first, and then we try to figure out a cool action sequence that would work within that story. And the same goes with every other genre as well. Like, if you watch the original Exorcist movie, The Exorcism, it's fascinating, and it's not jam-packed with horror and blood and I don't know, gore and whatnot, but there is enough there, and it comes in at the right moment, and it keeps the tension up. Whereas nowadays, you watch a horror movie from the first moment the movie starts, people start getting killed and murdered and all that. It takes away from it. There's no build-up. Yeah.
Do you think, you know, and I think with a lot of indie films in general, I think part of the reason why they work so well is, do you find this, that you're in such a restrictive environment, both, you know, with the tools you have. Does that force you to find maybe more creative solutions,
yeah,
and or maybe access to ideas that you wouldn't have if you're on this big budget film?
Yeah, that's true. It's, you start thinking other ways to figure the solution, to figure out a solution for your predicament, or come up with a way to not compromise the production value. And a lot of the times you're surprised by how simple yet complicated in a way it was to be able to pull it off. But for example, like in season one, episode three, we have a border, Canada, US border, where we shot every, like, people. And when we did it and pulled it off and got it done, never thought that would resonate so much with people. Everybody who's seen that episode has been raving about how impressed they were that we got an actual border. And it's not an actual border. It's simply a truck weighing station, for trucks on our way to Putnam, Ontario. And that's it.
I think one element that's present in every action film is the car chase.
Yeah.
Why is that such an effective trope for that specific type of story?
That's a very good question. I think it does have a lot to do with the keeping the, it creates tension without you trying to, without having anything to do necessarily with the story. You can watch a car chase video online that two cars are chasing one another. You're going to be rooting for the car that's trying to get away, simply without even knowing anything about the car that's chasing it. It's in the fabric of this type of action in films that creates tension and interest, and it draws the audience in. And I think it has to do with getting your adrenaline up. And everybody gets excited over fast cars or fast bikes or fast planes or just this sensation of speed.
You've been an actor, a writer, a director, a producer. You've been an investigative journalist.
Yeah.
How would you describe yourself?
I'm. Thank you, first of all, for saying all those things. And I hate to call myself an actor, director, writer, and all those things. I consider myself a filmmaker, a storyteller, and that's about it. If I get a chance, if I'm given the opportunity to be in front of the camera, and I would love to do it. But if not, I'm out there creating my own projects and telling the stories that I really want to tell. So I'm a filmmaker.
What makes a good story for you?
That's a good question. Great ending. And it may sound weird to some people, but to me, for me, a good story starts at a great ending. And when I do have a lot of projects that have been that I've written haven't been developed and haven't gotten a chance yet because I'm fairly new. I'm just starting, but I always started at the end. I always start at the end and then work backwards. So a great and powerful and punchy ending to me is the start of a good story. However, I do like stories that it's hard to say a flawless story, but a whole and complete story. Stories that come from a place of origin or truth or authenticity, whereas, oh, let's write a crime drama or writers who try to write something where it becomes a carbon copy of other movies that are already out there.
Do you think Canadian cinema has a unique style, or, you know, maybe is there an identifying marker that you see sort of littered amongst Canadian films and especially Canadian indies?
Oh, Canadian indies are, I should separate them from generally Canadian cinema, and I have a lot of respect for Canadian filmmakers and Canadian indie filmmakers because they really try out there. But there are also some filmmakers here where I find in Canada, people become very conservative when it comes to filmmaking and cinema in general, and that could hurt the art and the intention, because a lot of times what happens is, if the US, with TV, like, that's a guarantee, that's for sure, like, they take no chances. If they do it in the US and it works, then we try to come up with our own version of it. But in film, that's sort of applies as well, because they don't want to tell very edgy stories or take chances on stories that may have a little bit of a different angle. And I think that would hurt. That hurts. And especially in the long run, it's gonna, watering it down is not gonna help the art grow.
Where do you think we are with diversity on screen?
Oh, it's getting really, especially in Canada, I gotta say, it's great, because Canada is embracing the with every funding agency and programs out there having a diversity program for minorities and women and indigenous people and all of that, and trying to include as many different point of views as humanly possible. And I love what happened in 2017, where I think it was also CFC did that, and also there was another agency that applied this, where they were giving more, or I shouldn't say more, but it was same chance, equal chance to women filmmakers, female filmmakers out there, so that in order for them to be able to tell their stories, as opposed to judging the book by the cover. And obviously you gotta pick a project that's best, and doesn't matter whether it's a female or a male a creator behind it. But at the same time, there's a lot of women who get discouraged because they think of the film industry and entertainment industry as a very male-driven, male-oriented industry. And I think that these programs help encourage those women out there to come forward.
We sort of touched on politics a little bit earlier. Yeah. And there is an election coming up in Iran this year. You know, earlier everyone was sort of glued to what was happening in Alabama.
Yeah.
How important is it for Canada and the rest of the world to not only pay attention to what is happens in Iran, but you think world politics in general?
I think especially right now is very important, very crucial, especially because of the nowadays we live in the social media world, and the world in general has become a much smaller place, and we're much more connected and interrelated than we were before. You can simply, my family can go down the street in Iran and Skype with you, and you can see what's going on in real time in their neighborhood. And given the current political climate in Iran and what's going on down there and people protesting and the social unrest, I think it's very important to pay attention. I don't want to know what's going to happen with the election or if it's going to get to that, because every day there is new demonstration that in each and every city of Iran. And I think it's very important for Canada, U.S., and generally the West to pay close attention, watch, and support the freedom of people of Iran, and so that people know that there is support from outside for them, and they're not just on their own and alone.
Okay. All right, a few lighter questions now. Is there one dream role that you want to do either on stage or in film?
Oh, dream role, like in films about acting, you mean? On stage, I'd love to play Iago from Othello, Shakespearean play, and if I ever get a chance to do that, that would be phenomenal. In movies, I don't know. I have no idea. I'd love to act, so if there are offers out there, I would do it. I don't know. I don't have a specific taste for movies. I don't.
What is your biggest guilty pleasure?
My biggest guilty pleasure is watching talk shows. I watch a lot of talk shows. That's my thing at night. Like when I'm done work, I watch every single episode of every talk show out there.
Who's your current favorite late night host?
Oh, Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel, and then it's Seth Meyers in the very same order, and then it's Stephen Colbert. And I watch Fallon too.
What do you make of the fact that sort of the late night hosts have sort of become the voice of the revolution,
right?
In a way, like it's very strange.
It's crazy to me. They're news. Like I have a lot of my friends don't even have cable TV, so they watch everything online because internet. And they get like my good friend was actually telling me the other day. He's like, we were talking about like what Trump had done a few days ago, and it's like, yeah, I saw it on Colbert. I'm like, you get your news from Colbert? He's like, yeah, I swear to God. Like, yeah. It's just, it's been, and I think that given the current political climate in the U.S., it's the best time for late night hosts, because they get so much material, and they could not have been more relevant.
Well, I think Oliver won a Peabody the other, last year for when he interviewed Snowden.
It was insane. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I saw that. Yeah, yeah. That was great.
Current Netflix binge watch.
Oh. There were a couple. So I did. I finished Narcos, the last season, and it was good. And I watched this show, which I highly recommend. And if crime drama type of thing is your cup of tea. It's an Italian show on Netflix called Suburra. It's based on an Italian movie called Suburra that was made a few years ago, but it's a TV show. Very well done, very well crafted, and I just enjoy. I binge watched the whole thing in like 3 days, and yeah, I hate myself for that.
Favorite movie
of all time?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know, man. That's a tough one. I got a lot. There are. If I had to pick just one, it would have probably been On the Waterfront.
Okay.
With Marlon Brando and Ilya Kazan directing. That's one of But again, like that's such an it's not fair because there are a lot of other movies that I definitely enjoy.
Biggest misconception about Iran.
Oh, yeah. Biggest misconception about Iran is that it's just a Middle Eastern country. Because it's not. Iran is vastly different from Syria, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from the countries, from our neighbor countries. And it's in terms, like geographically and demographically, and even in terms of urban design, my country is very different from other our neighbor countries, and culturally as well. And a lot of times people think that we're Arabs, and we're not. And I don't personally care when people like, confuse that, because I consider myself Canadian, I especially when I'm here, because this Canada took me in when I had nowhere to go, and I took refuge here, and it's always in my heart, and this is my home and my land. Although I was born in Iran, and I would never forget where I came from and where my motherland is. But there's nothing wrong with having a stepmom. But I think a lot of times there are really hardcore Persians out there that hate it when people confuse Iranians with Arabs, and they think that you're all Middle Eastern. So I personally don't like that generalization either, painting everybody with the same brush, because every country has its own culture and tradition. So yeah, we're not just another Middle Eastern country.
Do you have a dream co-star?
Oh, dream co-star? Jesus Christ, you're asking all these crazy questions. Yeah, so many. Everybody in Hollywood, pretty much. there's a lot. But if I had to pick one, like younger, it would be Tom Hardy. Older, it would be literally anyone. Dustin Hoffman, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even after all the sort of.
Oh yeah,
kind of stuff that came out about him
and all that. Yeah, just to go and slap him right in the face.
Best place to get poutine in Toronto.
In Toronto, there is this new poutinery place that opened up right across from my place. I've had their poutine; it's fucking fantastic. It's the Young Shepherd. Where do you think it is?
I mean, I've only been here a few months now, so I've only ever had smokes, which is really good. Yeah. And there was a smokes location in Vancouver too. I think the last time I had the pulled pork poutine, that was really good.
Have you been to Montreal?
Yes.
Yeah. Have you had the poutine there?
Oh man, there's so much poutine in Montreal.
You can't compare.
I mean, you're going for poutine in Montreal at like 2 a.m.
I know. So, I know.
What is your favorite vacation spot?
Very good question. The latest place I've been, I got married recently, and for my honeymoon, we went to Jamaica. And I've never been to any of the Caribbean islands or places, so it was my first time, and it was like an all-inclusive type of thing. So I'd say Jamaica, because I fell in love with that place and the food.
What's one thing still on your bucket list that you want to do?
One thing on my bucket list. My bucket list is pretty full, I gotta say. There's a lot there that I haven't been checked off, but living in France is definitely one of them. I do want to do that.
South of France, like specific part.
Yeah, Marseille.
Marseille.
Yeah.
Old, nice little old. I know. Old town. So, we got Detainee X coming out, I think, on the 12th.
I think so. That's what 12th? I've been told. I don't know if they're going to change the date, but that's on Manny if they do.
And does Passport Control have a release date yet?
It doesn't have a release date. It has been picked up by Breakthrough Entertainment, which is a Canadian distribution company. And we are hoping for, we're aiming for TIFF this year, 2018. So we want to premiere a TIFF, fingers crossed. And but yeah, it doesn't have a set release date as of yet.
And Petrol Season 2 will be out.
No idea.
No idea yet.
That's,
no
worries. That's still being worked on and figured out. So we'll see.
Well, Reza Sholeh, thanks for chatting.
Thanks for having me, man.
Cheers.